Good evening, and welcome to this, the first Socratic Club meeting of this academic year. For those of you unfamiliar with this organization, the very first Socratic Club was started by C.S. Lewis at Oxford University in 1941 with the goal of providing an open forum for the discussion of intellectual difficulties associated with religion and with Christianity in particular. 6 years ago, a group of students established a similar organization on the Oregon State campus. Each year, the club features 6 debates, which provide a forum for opposing points of view on subjects of contemporary debate at the intersection of Christianity and contemporary culture. Tonight's debate, titled, "Is Christianity Good for the World?" is part of Cicero's Podium, Great Issues Debate Series, administered by the Intercollegiate Studies Institute. Each debate seeks to exemplify civil discourse, promote genuine intellectual diversity, and encourage the rising generation to think about the people and the ideas that have formed our experience in ordered liberty. To watch other Cicero's Podium debates, or to become a member of ISI, please visit www.isi.org. This debate focuses on what is arguably one of the most important questions in the culture wars of today. A number of recent books, such as Sam Harris's The End of Faith, Richard Dawkins' The God Delusion, and Christopher Hitchens' God is Not Great, argue that religion in general, and Christianity in particular, constitute a harmful force in society, fostering intolerance, anti-intellectualism, and the oppression of women. The conservative author Dinesh D'Souza, and cultural scholar, and the libertarian skeptic writer and social scientist Michael Shermer will discuss these and related issues tonight. In this debate, we will follow this format. Each speaker will have approximately 25 minutes to give his monologue. We'll follow this with a series of questions for roughly 15 minutes. This will be followed by the time for the audience to question the speakers, and finally, the speakers will give their closing remarks. Before I introduce the first speaker, I'm going to lay down a few house rules. Because of problems in the past, we ask that you not distribute flyers from anybody other than the Socratic Club or ISI during this debate. Also, please take this opportunity to turn off your cell phones. This is being recorded. And finally, we ask that you sit back, hold on to your questions until it's your time, and enjoy the discussion. Our first speaker tonight is Dinesh D'Souza. He's a fellow at the Hoover Institution at Stanford University. Investor Business Daily called him one of the top young public policy makers in the country. And the New York Times Magazine named him one of America's most influential conservative thinkers. Before joining the Hoover Institution, Mr. D'Souza was the John M. Olin Fellow at the American Enterprise Institute from 1985 to 1987. He was managing editor of Policy Review. In 97 to 98, he served as senior policy analyst at the Reagan White House. His books include the New York Times bestseller, What's So Great About America? His 1991 book, Illiberal Education, was the first study to publicize the phenomenon of political correctness. His latest book, What's So Great About Christianity, came out this week. D'Souza's articles have appeared in New York Times, Wall Street Journal, The Atlantic Monthly, Vanity Fair, New Republic, and National Review. Mr. D'Souza?
Thank you very much. I see I have a wide podium. I guess I didn't have to wear pants. Well, I'm very pleased, very honored to be here. I want to thank ISI and the Socratic Club for putting this event together. It's not a typical event on campus these days to take issues that deal with religion, bring them to the forefront, and fill an auditorium of this size is a tribute to the organizers and also to you. Our time in this debate is so limited, I have so much to say. I will try in my opening remarks to adopt the motto that King Henry VIII used with one of his wives. He said, "I won't keep you very long." We're here to talk about what is in some ways a universal but also a personal subject. I thought I would tell you just a little bit about myself and my way of thinking about this, and then also a little bit about the kind of approach I'm going to adopt in this debate. I'm a native of Bombay, India. I come from a part of India that's called Goa, which used to be, for many centuries, a Portuguese colony. I once asked my grandfather how our family became Christian, and he answered in three words: the Portuguese Inquisition. And so I discovered quite young in life that Christianity came to me, in a sense, at the point of a bayonet. And yet, interestingly, as I grew older and looked into it a little bit, I discovered that the Indians who converted to Christianity, most of them came from the so-called Dalit or untouchable class. So, frozen as they were in a bottom-rung status in life from which they were, no matter what their efforts, unable to escape, many people found in Christianity a doctrine of dignity and an assertion of the worth of individual life. And this was a powerful incentive for lots of low-caste Indians to flee into the arms of the missionaries. So it's possible that some bayoneting was involved, but it was also the case that the Indians found a great appeal and have remained over the centuries by their own choice Christian. I'm kind of inspired by the idea of the Socratic Club and the idea of having a debate which is not just a bit of a shouting match. A week from today, I'm debating Christopher Hitchens, the author of God Is Not Great, in New York City, and he's a little bit of a spear chucker, and I'm a little bit of a spear returner. But I think tonight I'm going to attempt, at least to initiate, a debate in which we genuinely are struggling to kind of get at the truth. The Socratic approach, I think, is a very good one for a university community. Now, we're talking about the role of Christianity in the West and in the world. And right away we realize that even though Christianity is a strong force in America, it is not a strong force in the public life of America. You could come from Mars and walk around America, watch the TV shows, go to the public square, and in some ways be very surprised to learn that the majority of Americans are in fact Christian. You don't see that much evidence of it in American public life. There is also, I want to suggest, in American intellectual life, a prejudice against Christianity. And this is not an overt prejudice. You don't have professors openly denouncing Christianity, scorning the resurrection, but if you look at the very language of the way we describe history, for example, the Christian era, the Dark Ages, the Christian era followed by the Renaissance, the Enlightenment. Enlightenment from what? Presumably from the prejudices implanted in Christianity. So all I'm trying to suggest is that the very vocabulary in which we think about history implants in our minds this idea of an era dominated by low and bad and dark things, followed by a sequence of wonderful things culminating, if you will, in the present. This sort of simple-minded view of history I'm going to try to contest. I'm also going to try to contest another idea that many people have, which is that as society becomes more modern, more urbanized, more educated, more enlightened, it becomes more secular. If you look at the example of Europe, you seem to have some corroboration of the secular thesis, but America is at the forefront of modernity, and America is a lot less secular than Europe. Moreover, the rapidly modernizing countries in the world today, India and China, are not only religious, but becoming evidently more so. I want to zoom in now and look a little bit at Christianity's role in the world, and specifically, what would our world be like if we didn't have Christianity? Christianity. I think of Western civilization as shaped by two pillars. On the one hand, Athens, and on the other hand, Jerusalem. By Athens, I mean classical reason. I'm thinking specifically of Greece and pre-Christian Rome. And by Jerusalem, I mean Judaism and Christianity. Without these two pillars, we would not have Western civilization as we know it. And the main institutions of the West have emerged out of a creative dynamic between Athens and Jerusalem. Very often in the academy, we give a lot of credit to Athens. We have an appropriately reverential attitude toward Athens. But we have a somewhat more scornful attitude toward Jerusalem. We underestimate Jerusalem's contribution, and this is particularly so because Athens, as we know it, is known to us through Jerusalem. In other words, the Aristotle that we know is not necessarily Aristotle as the ancient Greek saw him, but Aristotle as he has been perceived, if you will, through the lens of Christian history and Christian culture. If you think of the life of the ancient Greeks, it was in a way quite barbaric. It was a society for all its accomplishments in philosophy and art, accomplishments, I remind you, reserved to an infinitesimal portion of the population. These were societies dominated by slavery. They were societies in which human life had very little value. When the Spartans left their children, whether they were feeble or unfit, on the countryside to die of cold, they didn't stand out particularly for doing so. The attitude was ultimately a relatively low sense of human worth. Women were treated very poorly in ancient Greece and Rome. They were seen as a sort of appendage of their husbands. Aristotle, who's relatively enlightened on this matter, basically said that in the slave, reason is completely absent. In the child, reason is present, but undeveloped. In women, reason is present, but unused. And this reflects, if you will, the widespread perception of the ancient world. Christianity comes along and introduces some very new values. For the first time, human life takes on a sort of new worth. For the first time, the ordinary person, who mattered very little in Greece and Rome, suddenly becomes the object of a certain dignity. And the pursuits of the ordinary person, family life, trade, industry, bettering yourself, having, if you will, a decent life. We see this idea emerging through Christian history being emphasized in the Reformation. In a way I'll talk about in a moment, science, in the way we understand it today, is based on faith-based assumptions, so that even the scientist practicing today, whether he or she realizes it or not, is actually operating in a Christian framework which, if you were to remove it, modern science would come to an end. If you look at values that even secular people cherish, the value of individualism, that the individual matters, the social value of compassion. If somebody is suffering, you should feel for him or her. You should do something to alleviate that. Have you noticed that when there's a big famine or tsunami or catastrophe, the Western nations of the world all rush to help? And this seems natural to us. People don't think twice about it. It's the way we are. But it's not the way that human nature is. And the proof of that is that when tsunamis happen, other people in other cultures don't seem to react in the identical way. They react, if you will, with the philosophy expressed by the Russian proverb, "The tears of strangers are only water." In a way, the Russians are very much in a Darwinian tradition, by which I mean the idea that as surviving beings in a dog-eat-dog world, we should help those who are closely related to us. We should help our family, we should help our neighbors, we should help our tribe, but why on earth should we even put ourselves out for a guy who is nothing to us? Christianity introduces this notion and universalizes it, that we, in a sense, are all in this together, and we owe. Now, if you go back to ancient Greece and Rome, there was a virtue, not compassion. Aristotle actually scorns the idea of compassion. Aristotle celebrates liberality or magnanimity. Magnanimity is the demonstration of the superior man showing his greatness in deigning to help the lesser man. Magnanimity exists within a structure of inequality. It's very different from the notion of sympathy or compassion. We're all in this together. Let me talk, if I may, about the issue of equality. I was reading in Sam Harris's book, "The Christians have got to bear some responsibility for the institution of slavery. Didn't the Christians compromise with slavery for centuries?" and so on. Well, we have to remember that slavery was a universal institution. It existed in every society known to man. The Chinese had it. The Asian Indians had it. There were slaves in the Americas before Columbus got here. In a way, slavery for centuries was uncontroversial. It did not need any defenders because it had no critics. It was kind of like the family. Christianity is the first institution in the world that made slavery controversial. Christianity is the first movement in the world to create and lead an anti-slavery movement. First the Quakers and then the evangelical Christians basically said this. They said, look, we learn from our faith that all men are equal in the eyes of God. And for centuries, this was seen as a spiritual insight. It applied to the next world, but not necessarily to this world. But the Quakers and the evangelical Christians said, if we are all equal in the eyes of God, it follows that no man has the right to rule another man without his consent. And this idea became the foundation not only for anti-slavery, not only for the abolition movement, it also became the moral foundation of democracy. Democracy, too, is based on the principle that no man has the right to rule another without consent. So Christianity here becomes, if you will, the soil out of which the anti-slavery movement, representative democracy, grows. And that's why these things happened in the West and nowhere else. They could be exported abroad later, but they started in this civilization and no other. Now ask yourself this question. Why is modern science a Western idea? In other words, if you go to other cultures, you have intellectual curiosity. The Mayans develop a calendar. The Chinese recorded the eclipses. The Hindus invented the number zero. But science, in the structure that we have it today, as a kind of institution, science seems to have developed not in every civilization, but in this one. Why? I want to suggest that the reason it did is science is based ultimately on an assumption that can only be described as theological. In fact, not one, but three theological premises, all derived from Christianity. Premise number one, the universe as a whole is rational. The universe as a whole follows laws. Now, this may seem very obvious to you if you've taken a physics class and you go, well, yeah, so? But the point is, it's not obvious. In fact, there is no necessity that it should be so. The Muslim thinker Al-Ghazali says that the universe exists in the mind of God. God intervenes at every single second to make everything that happens. It's not a question of law. It's a question of divine governance of everything that occurs. But no, modern science is based on the notion of a regular, an orderly, a lawful universe. Second, modern science is based on the idea that the rationality of the universe is comprehensible in the language of mathematics. If you think about it, this is a little bit odd. We know that human beings can act purposefully or lawfully, but how does the electron know what to do? How do inanimate objects know how to follow rules? And what rules? Newton's inverse square law, Einstein's rules. We have matter behaving as if it was purposeful, as if it was following a pattern or a program. So the universe is rational. It follows the rules of mathematics. And third, the rules of the universe are comprehensible to us. We can figure them out. That's odd if you think about it as well. Why should the neurons working in your head match and somehow be able to capture the rationality of the world out there? Now, as a Christian, I can answer those questions theologically. The universe is rational because it mirrors the rationality of God. It follows rules because the Creator is lawful and chose to make that kind of a universe. It is accessible to us because we have a stamp of the divine image, if you will, a mark of divine rationality in us, and therefore it's no surprise under a theological assumption that there is a sort of correspondence between the rationality out there and the rationality in here. But my point is that if you're an atheist, you have no way of knowing any of those things. Let's take a simple example. It is the premise of science that the laws of the universe follow a pattern of universality. For example, the speed of light, as measured, is considered to be the same everywhere in the universe. If I measure the speed of light in this room, 186,000 miles a second, I measure it on Jupiter, 186,000 miles a second. I assume that if I were to go to a star 5,000 light years away, the speed of light would be the same. Do I know that? Have I measured it? No. I assume it. I presume it. It is my operating model. Again, if you are a theist, you can say, well, yes, God has essentially ordained laws, and these laws are consistent, they're universal. But if you're an atheist, you don't know it. You are guessing. You are making this stuff up. You are operating, if you will, on theological assumptions, whether you are man enough to admit it or not. Now, not surprisingly, most of the great scientists of the past 5 centuries have been religious. Most of them, in fact, have been Christians. This is true of Boyle, Kepler, Galileo, Newton. The list goes on. And not only were they Christians, which right away, by the way, should give you pause when you hear the arrogant claims of people like Dawkins. And Dawkins is supposed to be the leading publicizer of science in the world. But Newton was the leading doer of science in the world. And Newton not only saw no contradiction between his faith and science, but even more, these great scientists saw their work as motivated by and leading to a discovery of the divine handiwork in the universe. A good example of this would be Kepler. When Kepler did his work, he discovered that the planets don't seem to be moving in perfect circles. And the theologian said to him, well, wouldn't God use the perfect image, which is the circle? And Kepler said, you know what? I'm pretty convinced that whatever pattern God used, when I just discover it, I will show you it is a far more beautiful, intricate, symmetrical, and ingenious pattern than you have thought of. And this, in fact, motivates my work to discover that pattern. And when Kepler laid out his 3 laws, he said very beautifully and very piously, this is ultimately the reflection of the handiwork of God. I've talked a little bit about science, a little bit about history. I now want to turn to a very common argument made on the other side, which is an argument made against Christianity and against religion, which is, isn't it true that for all its accomplishments, even if you admit them, that Christianity is responsible for a lot of the crimes and violence of the world, the violence of history, and moreover, if we look at the problems in the world today, from Northern Ireland to 9/11, we see that religion appears to have a pretty nefarious role in the world. I want to try to answer this argument in a rational way. First of all, as I look around the world, I see a lot of people fighting, and to the naive glance, it appears to be that they're fighting about religion. But if you look a little more closely, you see right away that they're not. Why are the Israelis and the Palestinians fighting? Are they fighting about whether Moses or Muhammad was a greater prophet? No. They're fighting over a piece of land that they both think belongs to them. Why are the Hindus and the Muslims fighting? They're fighting over Kashmir, not over religion. In Northern Ireland, they're fighting over identity and self-determination and self-rule. There's a joke about a guy in Belfast as he steps out of his apartment. A guy jumps behind him and says, pointing a gun to his head, Catholic or Protestant? And the guy says, actually, I'm an atheist. And the man says, Catholic atheist or Protestant atheist? But if you think about it, the point of the joke is, it's not really about religion. I think one of the things that the new atheists have done is to cunningly look at the crimes committed by the Islamic radicals in the name of Islam and to try to foist those same crimes on Christianity. Even if you look at history, you look at the Crusades. Well, the Crusades were a response to Muslim invasion and Muslim conquest. The Middle East was mostly Christian before the Muslims came along. They conquered it. Islamic armies came into Europe. They conquered parts of Italy, all of Spain. They overran the Balkans. They were at the gates of Vienna. Even Gibbon, no friend of Christianity, says that if the Christians hadn't blocked Muslim irredentism, today most of us would all be attending universities in which we'd be reading the Quran in the Arabic language. In other words, the Crusades were a necessary, although clumsy and ultimately only partially effective, way to block Islamic invasion and conquest. The Inquisition. I read Henry Kamen's book of his authoritative study of the Inquisition. I discover the number of people killed in the Inquisition over 3 centuries, 2,000. I read a book on the Salem witch trials, a scholarly study, the number of people put to death in Salem, 18. Yes, that's 2018 too many. But what about the crimes of atheism? Crimes committed not 500 or 1,000 years ago, but in our lifetimes, in the last century, by atheist regimes in the name of atheism. Richard Dawkins says, well, they didn't do it in the name of atheism. Oh, really? Have you read Marx's Communist have you read the Communist Manifesto? Have you read the works of Lenin? Have you read Stalin, Mao, Hitler? All of them wanted, not simply, they wanted to create a new man and a new utopia, liberated from traditional religion and traditional morality. And so they followed Dostoevsky's maxim, if God is not, everything is permitted. These three atheist dictators in a space of 4 decades killed more than 100 million people. I'm not even counting the second tier of atheists. I'm not counting Pol Pot. He has about 2 million. Fidel Castro, Ceausescu, Kim Jong-il. The list goes on. My point is, atheism, not religion, and most certainly not Christianity, is responsible for the mass murders of history. The bottom line of it, folks, is that we live in a world where human nature, as Immanuel Kant said, it's the crooked timber of humanity out of which no straight thing was ever made. Everybody has done some bad things, and some bad things have been done in the name of religion. But on the balance, when you compare the things that were done and the good that was done, we see that Christianity has come like a light into the world. It has made what we call Western civilization and all its values, it has made the world a huge degree better. At the end of it, I think we can all say, even Michael Shermer, thank God for Christianity. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Dinesh, for encouraging me to project a little bit better. Our next speaker is Dr. Michael Shermer. He is the publisher of Skeptic Magazine, a monthly columnist for Scientific American, and an adjunct professor in the School of Politics and Economics at Claremont Graduate University. Dr. Shermer's latest book is The Mind of the Market on Evolutionary Economics. His last book was Why Darwin Matters, Evolution and the Case Against Intelligent Design. And he is the author of Science Fiction, Where the Known Meets the Unknown, The Science of Good and Evil, Why People Cheat, Gossip, Share, Care, and Follow the Golden Rule, and How We Believe, Science, Skepticism, and the Search for God. He's also the author of Why People Believe Weird Things on Pseudoscience, Superstitions, and Other Confessions of Our Time. Dr. Shermer has an MA in experimental psychology from California State University, Fullerton, and a PhD in the history of science from Claremont Graduate University. Dr. Shermer?
Good evening. How are we doing? All right. Thank you. Good. Yes. Well, it's good to be here. And I had a really weird thing happen. Let's see. Are we picking me up here? Okay. Can you hear me all right? There we go. Okay. The voice of God has spoken. How many Christians, by the way, are here tonight? Oh, Jesus Christ. Oh, sorry. Look at the time. So today I had about an hour and a half to kill after checking in at the beautiful downtown Hilton Garden Inn here across the street. And so I put on my suit and I went out for a little walkabout. And, well, this weird thing happened. About a couple months ago, I was in Las Vegas and I went to a magic show, Penn & Teller's magic show, in which the final act of the show, Penn & Teller do this double bullet catch where they shoot shoot a 357 Magnum across the stage and they catch it, the bullet, in their teeth. And to prove that they're not doing some sleight of hand, even though, of course, they are, they have volunteers from the audience come up and sign the bullet casing in the one, and then sign the bullet itself, so that after the guns are fired, you can see that the bullet casing is still in the gun, and the bullet that's signed has now gone to the other side of the cage and is in the other guy's mouth. Right? Anyway, so I got to be one of the volunteers to go up and sign my bullet. Right? So I went up and I signed the bullet, and the bullet catch happened. And of course, I don't know how the trick is done, but it's done very well. And anyway, I got to keep my bullet. So I put this bullet in my jacket pocket. It was this coat I was wearing today that had the bullet in. I completely forgot about it. Anyway, so I walk out of the Hilton Garden Inn, and just as I'm going around the sidewalk, I hear this noise from above, the fourth story up there, and I look up, and it's a crazed evangelist. It's he, the Gideon's Bible, out the window, and it comes hurtling at me. The Bible strikes me in the chest and would have gone right through my heart if it weren't for that bullet. Stopped it. So I think that's a portent of things to come tonight, because I have to sort of turn things around a little bit. I want to make 5 points tonight in my 25 minutes. I used to be a born-again Christian. I went to Pepperdine University, where we went door-to-door witnessing for people. We used to call it Amway, sort of Bible, Amway on Bibles, something like that. And then later I became a born-again atheist, and I went around to those same doors and basically took it all back. And then I became, I guess what you might call a militant agnostic. I don't know and you don't either. It's a bumper sticker I once saw. I think that best summarizes it. Or the old joke, what do you get when you cross a Jehovah Witness with an atheist? It's someone who knocks on your door for no reason at all. So the answer to our question tonight, is Christianity good for the world? The obvious answer is, it depends. I mean, this is like asking, is government good for the world? Well, which government? I mean, religion is a huge, complex, socially entrenched entity that does all sorts of things, good and bad. Personally, I support, my favorite charity is World Vision. It's an evangelical Christian group because it works. And one of my best friends is head of their PR department. I adopted a little girl through them and so on. So there's plenty of good things that religion does. And the problem with a confrontational debate like this is, of course, his job is to tick off all the good things and my job is to tick off all the bad things. And really, of course, the answer is both. And the question on the table then is, in balance, in the main, is Christianity doing slightly more good than bad or slightly more bad than good? And I'm reminded of Winston Churchill's description of Americans when he said, you can always count on Americans to do the right thing after they've tried everything else. And I guess that's my sense about religion. You can always count on religion to do the right thing after it's tried everything else. Eventually, they do get around to it for other reasons. So, my second point then, since it's clear that we're debating a complex issue, which Christianity and good for whom? Catholic, Protestant, Evangelical, Mormon, Episcopalian, Pentecostal? According to the 2001 World Christian Encyclopedia, there are no less than 33,820 Christian denominations. 33,000 worldwide Christian denominations. Which Christianity is doing the good and which is not? And good for whom? Individuals, society, communities, political states? What are we talking about? This is not defined. I mean, we have Protestant Christians determined to murder Catholic Christians over turf and politics in Northern Ireland. This is not good. Mormon Christians who belong to the fundamentalist Church of Jesus Christ, the Latter-day Saints, believe that it is acceptable to force 13-year-old girls to have sex with men five times their age. This is not good. Pentecostal Christians who indoctrinate young children at Jesus camps into becoming warriors for Christ who are willing to kill for their Lord. This is not good. Evangelical Christians who believe so strongly in the sanctity of life that they blow up abortion clinics and murder doctors. This is not good. Or Catholic Christians whose priestly pedophile program of, in the words of my friend Christopher Hitchens, "No Child's Behind" left. This is not good. Speaking of homosexuality, my third point is a case study of what's wrong with religion today, especially with Christianity. You guys are really missing the boat here on homosexuality and gay marriage. You'll get around to it eventually for other reasons, as my Churchillian quote said. The overwhelming evidence from science shows that gender preferences are primarily determined by genetics and prenatal biochemistry, especially embryological hormone balance. Almost everyone is born attracted to members of the opposite sex. A tiny percentage, maybe 1 or 2%, maybe even less than 1%, are attracted to members of the same sex. So what? Asking a homosexual when he or she chose to become gay is like asking a heterosexual when he or she chose to become straight. Nevertheless, on this particular issue, Christianity remains mired in pre-civil rights, pre-enlightenment, pre-scientific, medieval, barbaric thinking. Basing their beliefs on a single biblical passage, Leviticus 18:22, "Thou shalt not lie with mankind as with womankind, it is abomination." This quote, by the way, this commandment, is tucked in between other passages that instruct parents to kill disobedient children and to execute adulterous wives and non-virgin brides. That's right, the death penalty for adultery. Well, if we impose this today, this would immediately eliminate a good number of Christian congressmen and senators, preachers, and televangelists. You might ask yourself why some of these preachers and politicians like Ted Haggard or Larry Craig are so obsessed with being against homosexuality. Methinks the gentleman doth protest too much, as we've now seen in those two cases. Whenever somebody obsesses about gays, you might suspect them of something else going on there, in my opinion. Anyway, as a consequence of this embarrassing lapse of Christian charity and Jesus' doctrine of love for all humanity, Christian preachers and writers, theologians, think nothing of tormenting gays by telling them that their desire to love another person of the same sex is an abomination, by telling them that they have a disease that can be cured through a treatment. These treatment programs, by the way, involve things like watching football. I mean, it's so pathetic. It's something you would see as satire on the Stephen Colbert Report. And that promiscuity is evil, but that the single best prophylactic against promiscuity, marriage, is legally banned from them. Christians actually believe that they're being charitable by proclaiming that they hate the sin but not the sinner, which is not dissimilar to what Christians declared just before torching women for allegedly practicing witchcraft in order to save their souls because we love them. Or when Christians called for pogroms against Jews for being Christ killers, may I point out that if Jesus had to die for your sins, that means somebody had to kill him. So instead of hating Jews for this, you should thank them. Judas should have a statue in Jerusalem as the hero for the guy who did it. Anyway, mark my words, here is what is going to happen. Within a decade, maybe two or three, Christians will come around to treating gays no differently than they now treat members of other groups whom they previously persecuted, women, Jews, and blacks, but not because of some new interpretation of a biblical passage or because of some new revelation from God, these changes will come about the same way they always do, by the oppressed minority fighting for the right to be treated equally, and by a few enlightened members of the oppressing majority supporting their cause. Then what will happen is that Christians will take credit for the civil liberation of gays, dig through the historical record, find a few Christian bloggers or preachers who had the courage and the character to stand up for gay rights and their fellow Christians when their fellow Christians would not, and then cite those as evidence that were it not for Christianity, gays would not be equal. Anyway, that's enough on that. Point four, last 2 points. Religion and societal morality, and then religion and individual morality. In a 2005 study published in the Journal of Religion and Society, independent scholar Gregory Paul found an inverse correlation, that is, as one variable goes up, the other one goes down, between religiosity, as measured by belief in God, biblical literalism, and frequency of prayer and service attendance, and societal health, measured by rates of homicide, suicide, childhood mortality, life expectancy, sexually transmitted diseases, abortion, and teen pregnancy in 18 developed democracies. In general, higher rates of belief in and worship of a creator, this is nationally now, across these 18 different democratic nations, higher rates of belief in and worship of a creator correlate with higher rates of homicide, juvenile early adult mortality, STD infection rates, teen pregnancy, and abortion in the prosperous democracies. Paul concludes, quote, "The United States is almost always the most dysfunctional of the developed democracies, sometimes spectacularly so. The United States scores the highest by far in religiosity of these 18 developed democracies, and the highest by far in homicides, STDs, abortions, and teen pregnancies." Now, conservative Christians, of course, will blame secular liberals for all of these societal evils. But with over 90% of Americans proclaiming themselves to be Christians, and the country roughly divided 50-50 between conservative and liberals, the math doesn't add up. Whatever else may be the cause of these different social ills, obviously religion is not a prophylactic against those things. It is not a moral guideline to control those kinds of issues. Five, finally, religion and individual morality. 1934, Abraham Franz Blau found a negative correlation between acceptance of religious beliefs and three different measures of honesty. As religiosity increased, honesty decreased. 1950, Murray Ross conducted a survey among 2,000 associates of the YMCA and discovered that agnostics and atheists were more likely to express their willingness to aid the poor than those who rated themselves as deeply religious. 1969, sociologists Travis Hershey and Rodney Stark reported no difference in the self-reported likelihood to commit crimes between children who attended church regularly and those who did not. 1975, Ronald Smith, Gregory Reeler, and Edward Diner discovered that college-age students in religious schools were no less likely to cheat on a test than their atheist and agnostic counterparts in non-religious schools. 1996, George Barna, a born-again evangelical Christian and professional pollster, in his index of leading spiritual indicators, based on interviews with nearly 4,000 adult Americans, revealed, quote, "Born-again Christians continue to have a higher likelihood of getting divorced than do non-Christians." And, quote, "Atheists are less likely to get divorced than are born-again Christians." Barna found that the current divorce rate for born-again Christians is 27%, while it is only 24% for non-Christians. In addition, yeah, amen. In addition, the baby boomers, the generation often criticized for sexual indulgence and moral relativism, has a lower rate of divorce, 34%, than the preceding generation, portrayed in popular culture as the idealized 1950s Ozzie and Harriet family, who hover around 37%. All right, that's 1996. How about 5 years later? In a 2001 survey, Barna found that 33% of all born-again individuals who have been married have gone through a divorce, which is statistically identical to the 34% incidence among non-born-again adults. In other words, sorry for the data dump there, but the point of all this is that religion seems to have no relationship at all to marital standing, divorce, and so forth. And this, I picked George Barna because he is an evangelical Christian. His point of publishing all this data is for the church to get its own house in order, because for the obvious hypocrisy problems there. Finally, most recently, this last July-August issue of the Annals of Family Medicine published the results of a study conducted by researchers from the University of Chicago and Yale New Haven Hospital that religious doctors were no more likely, and even slightly less likely, to employ their craft among underserved patients than were physicians with no religious affiliation. Specifically, the lead investigator on this, Farr Curlin, MD and associate professor of medicine at the University of Chicago, and his colleagues surveyed 1,820 practicing physicians from all different specialties. 31% of the physicians who were more religious practiced medicine among the underserved, compared to 35% of atheist, agnostic, and non-religious doctors. Religiosity was measured by religious service attendance and self-reported intrinsic religiosity, questions that measure the extent to which individuals embrace a religion as the master motive that guides and gives meaning to their life. Curlin noted his own shock at this. Curlin is a Christian. Quote, "This came as both a surprise and a disappointment. The Christian, Jewish, Muslim, Hindu, and Buddhist scriptures all urge physicians to care for the poor. And the great majority of religious physicians describe their practice of medicine as a calling. Yet, we found that religious physicians were not more likely to report practice among the underserved than their secular colleagues." There was one interesting finding that Curlin made. There was a difference. Those who identified themselves as very spiritual, whether they were religious or not, were roughly twice as likely to care for the underserved as those who described their spirituality as low. Quote, "Part of this divergence between religion and spirituality can be traced to a rift between Christian denominations in the late 19th and early 20th century," Curlin concludes. "About a century ago," he noted, "many of the mainline and liberal Protestant churches began to emphasize efforts to right social injustices, while the more conservative churches tended to stress doctrinal orthodoxy. Research indicates that those who consider themselves spiritual but not so religious are more likely to be in the more liberal denominations." Okay, the point of this is again, splitting this, Christianity is too large a concept. We have to break this down. Who are we talking about here? Okay, it's the more liberal, the more secularized Christianities, the people that consider themselves to be spiritual. Those are the ones, at least in this study, and physicians, who were more likely to help. Why? Because they have their priorities straight of what really matters. Consider the difference in this own field. Say, between Rick Warren, author of A Purpose-Driven Life, who I had the chance to spend a weekend with and found him to be a remarkable man, versus, say, the Ted Haggard, James Dobson focus on the family branch of Christianity. That is, caring and being concerned about those outside of our immediate sphere, those who are truly needy, poor, people in Africa, so on, or even the poor here, AIDS in Africa, whatnot. Versus that Ted Haggard, James Dobson approach of, we really deeply care about your personal morality, what you're doing in your private lives. If you follow the James Dobson approach of Christianity, we are to believe that the creator of the universe's biggest concern is what consenting adults are doing with their sex organs in the privacy of their bedrooms. This is what these Christians deeply care about, which I contend is where religion goes deeply wrong, especially Christianity. So in conclusion, the problem with any kind of extreme absolutism, particularly in religion where it flourishes so much, is that it leads to absolute intolerance. Once you believe that you have the absolute and final answers to moral questions, why be tolerant of those who refuse to accept your truth? Religiously based moral systems apply this principle in spades. From the medieval Crusades and the Spanish Inquisition to the Holocaust in Bosnia, history is rife with examples of intolerance. In the name of their religion, people have lighted faggots to burn women accused of witchcraft. In the name of God, religious people have sanctioned slavery, anti-Semitism, racism, homophobia, torture, genocide, ethnic cleansing, and war. Not only does religion not necessarily make one more moral, it can lead to greater intolerance, racism, sexism, and the erosion of other values cherished in a free and democratic society. Now, where I would disagree with my friends Richard Dawkins and Christopher Hitchens, this idea that if we just got rid of religion, this would solve these kinds of conflicts. I don't think so. I disagree with both of them and with Dinesh D'Souza. Humans are by nature tribal. We naturally divide ourselves up into in-groups and out-groups. That comes from our evolutionary heritage. Within our groups, we're very pro-social, cooperative, altruistic, and so forth. Between groups, we're very competitive, bellicose, xenophobic. And so the key to this problem is how to solve that problem. One of the things that religion does poorly is to encourage more in-group, out-group division. I think the great biblical authors have struggled with this over the ages. In the early books of the Old Testament, they talk about love thy neighbor. Well, in the early stages of the development of Judaism, thy neighbor was thy immediate fellow in-group member, in which that is who you are to project your altruism, pro-social, cooperative energies. And that's why the parts of the Old Testament are filled with all these disastrous, awful stories about the rape and murder and pillage of those other guys not in our group. That's what that was all about. By the end of the Old Testament, particularly, say, by the book of Ruth, thy neighbor becomes members of the out-group. So by the time the Christians get around to it with Jesus' Sermon on the Mount, the Jews had already figured this out. So there was a natural flow, a natural transition in culture to being much more inclusive of people not in our in-group. So while religion can have part of that, there's something else going on here. That religion, in my opinion, more often follows the cultural trend rather than leads it. So in conclusion, it's a huge subject. Religion is great and wonderful for many people on many levels, and that part of religion I like, including the parts of Christianity that does that. But it also does many great and terrible things, great in terms of large, terrible things. And that part we can't endorse. So the point of a free society in which we have a legal system that protects us all to believe or disbelieve what we want, we can sort these things out peacefully through events like this. Thank you. Okay, we go over here.
At this point, our speakers will engage in some dialogue. We will start with Dr. Shermer, who will ask the first question. This will go on for several minutes, and then I'll ask Mr. D'Souza to question Dr. Shermer. Following the previous monologue, we do ask, these are topics that are near and dear to all of our hearts, one side and the other, but please hold back your passions, make your seat twitch, but don't let your voice come out.
What?
So with that, and notice we didn't include any stones on the stage either. So Dr. Shermer, please initiate this for us.
So how about those Packers this weekend? So, Dinesh, I guess my first question is a philosophical one. Do moral standards purportedly set down by God exist separately from God? If so, then belief in God is not necessary, right? And if no, then those moral standards are subject to the whims of God, and that's why we see all these differing moral stories in the Old Testament. So in matters of human law, we can abide by a law without any knowledge of or belief in its author. Why can't the same be true of divine law?
Well, I would agree with you that moral standards are embedded, if you will, within human nature itself. They are embedded within human nature, I think, by God. In part, I say that because I cannot think of any evolutionary explanation for morality. Now, I realize there's a whole body of evolutionary scholarship, as you noted, trying to show why people benefit others who share their genes. I'm familiar with all that. But if I were to get up to give someone a seat in a bus who's nothing to me, or if, as in the Bible, the man helps the Samaritan who's a complete stranger, or if you donate blood without any hope of recompense, or if you say, give me liberty or give me death, or if you say, love thy neighbor, these ideas, it seems to me, can't be explained by an extended form of selfishness. So, can you practice them without resort to God? Sure. But who put them there? I think God did.
So if I could convince you that there was a good evolutionary model, would you concede that it's possible God used evolution to create the moral sentiments within humans?
I would certainly concede that that's possible, yes.
Okay. Chapter 7 of this book here, we'll get you there. Anyway. Because I do think there are good, but it would take too long. We can do that in the Q&A. And along these lines of Old Testament, New Testament moralities, assuming that these moral principles really exist there somewhere, given to us by God, how do you know what they are?
Well, I think that, well, the first thing to note about this is that morality is a human thing. There is, would you agree with me that there is no human species or group that is outside of morality? Morality is human, correct?
Yes, I would say the best that they get with primates
okay.
is pre-moral.
Now, there's been, Darnell Brown has a study called Human Universals, the anthropologist, in which he describes more than 300 things that all humans from whatever culture have in common. This alone, I think, is an adequate refutation of sort of an extreme form of relativism that holds that essentially morality is purely individual or purely a matter of one group or the other group. He shows no, although that may be true at the margin, the core elements of human nature include a moral dimension, and he specifies very clearly what those are. So, if something is universal, has existed in all cultures, it seems to me that that is a good case for saying that that is part of our nature. Why else would it have developed everywhere? If you look at the moral rules and ask this question, which I also ask about physical laws, which is to say, how can you have laws without a lawgiver? There's nothing in our experience that would suggest that it's possible for immaterial things. I mean, there's nothing in our experience that says that this bottle of water has intention and purpose and can follow rules. If you have rules, whether the rules of nature, which can be called science, or the rules of human nature, either way, I think there is strong inferential evidence that these laws presume a lawgiver. Where else do they come from?
But how do you know what they are? I mean, divine revelation from God himself, because you heard the voice?
No.
Read it in a holy...
No. I would separate theology from morality. The principles of theology, for example, the Trinity. I think that's the province of revelation. I would never try to persuade you based on reason to accept the Trinity. On the other hand, the golden rule, that's a moral principle. I would defend it on the basis of reason. I think that reason itself has been implanted by God. I would be hopeful that I could convince a Hindu or a Buddhist or even an atheist that it's a good rule to follow. So in that sense, these moral principles are in our nature. The atheist isn't so much rejecting God. The atheist is turning away from the voice of conscience in himself and denying that aspect of God imprinted on him or on her.
So what I'm after here is sort of divine law, natural law, difference in, let's say, within natural law, I would throw my own theory of evolutionary origins of the moral sentiment. How do, outside of natural reason to get at natural law, how would you get at divine law? Short of asking and he tells you or she tells you.
There is no way to get a divine law other than some version of God told me. So that's why when it comes to divine law, there is no way to argue for it on the basis of, you can say, secular reason. On the other hand, you can understand this better by looking at something concrete. Take the abolition of slavery, for example. I would say that you can't reasonably argue that there is an evolutionary argument for why you shouldn't have slaves. You know, as I do, that for millennia, human beings have had slaves. It was there in all cultures. If evolution kicked against it, we wouldn't have it. But we had it for a long time. How did it stop? It stopped by someone asserting a principle that you asserted repeatedly in your speech, the principle of human equality. Now, I would ask you, where does that principle come from? I would argue, I say historically, it comes from a theological principle translated into a social principle. So here's a case where God is the author, but man posits a natural law rooted in the divine law, applies it to politics, and that law is so effective that today you, as an atheist, but you're still an atheist with a Christian morality, still argue for that principle in defending gay rights and defending anti-slavery and defending women, and you say the Christians will take credit for it. The Christians should take credit for it because the principle of equality is a Christian principle.
Then why are Christians not supporting gay rights and gay marriage?
Because in life there are moral propositions. Equality is one of them. Human dignity is another. But there are also injunctions against sins, immorality, and so on. So it's not the case. I mean, there are times when principles come into conflict. You want to respect someone's dignity, but you also feel that what they're doing is wrong, and you have to figure out some way to reconcile those competing principles.
Based on that one passage, and surely you would not endorse execution for adulterous women and disobedient children, right?
Right.
So why?
I feel strongly about that.
Why hang on to the gay thing? Why hang on to the gay thing and dump the others? I mean, what's your criteria? What do you judge to say, okay,
all right.
This one and dump the other one?
Well, let's explore this, Michael. I mean, if you look at marriage, I see four aspects of the definition of marriage. Okay, four parts of the definition. Part number one, marriage has to involve two people and no more. Number two, these two people have to be adults. They can't be children. Number three, these two people have got to be unrelated to each other. They can't be brother and sister, for example, incest. Number four, one has to be a man, the other has to be a woman. You want to uproot principle number four. Why do you want to preserve principles one, two, and three?
Well, wait, in Tennessee, I mean, if you take the Mormons, you can ask me that when it's your turn to ask questions. In Joseph Smith's theology, who fully accepted Christ as the Savior, he had a revelation from God. And then, in 1896, suddenly, after the U.S. government says, you're not going to be doing this anymore, there was a new revelation from God in which they said, God changed his mind, apparently, about polygamy. Isn't this a classic example of Christianity following a cultural trend, not leading it?
Well, I understand that there's another new one coming out from Mitt Romney, but anyway.
Who said, fewer wives than Giuliani, but that's another.
Romney says he thinks marriage should be between a man and a woman, and a woman, and a woman, and a woman, and so on. Well, I don't want to go down this road only because, you know, in fairness, the Mormons, the Latter-day Saints, would not be considered as being mainstream Christians. But the broader point I think you're getting at here is a good one, and that is that we are human beings struggling to intuit and figure out and determine something whose origins are divine. It doesn't surprise me that different religions struggle with this, come up with different ways to get at it. In Islam, for example, there is a respect for the traditional family, but you can take up to four wives. Now, Islam disagrees with Christianity on theology. The morality of the world's major religions is not far apart. In fact, Hans Kuhn, the liberal theologian, assembled what he called the Parliament of World Religions, and he got people to sit down on a round table, and most of the moral propositions they agreed with. And I would submit that even secular people would agree with most of them. So all of this is a way of saying that ultimately religion here is supplying a transcendent basis for morality, and something very important, I think, for us fallible human beings, which is the notion of an ultimate cosmic accounting. You know and I know we live in a world where bad people succeed and good people come to grief. Wouldn't we all act a little bit better in the world if we felt that ultimately what goes around does come around? We know that that's not true in life. When people say what goes around comes, they know that that's a lie. A lot of times the bad guy gets away with it, the good guy comes. So the idea that there is cosmic justice in the world and that at some time, ultimately, we will all get our comeuppance. I mean, that's a little bit of a scary idea, but in some ways it establishes fundamental justice in the world. I think religion has done a lot of good by cementing that idea in the human mind.
I would like that to be true. For the same reason I would like, well, when I'm asked what's my position on the afterlife, I always say, I'm for it, of course. I hope it's true. But what I know from psychology is that what I'd like to be true and what is true are not always the same. And And it would be nice if there was an ultimate lawgiver where Hitler really doesn't get away with it. Yes, that would be nice. But I don't know that that's true, and I don't think anybody else does either, which is why we still have these debates. So short of that, we do need a legal system, do we not, to settle these things now in this world as best we can, just in case it's not all going to be settled in the next world.
Of course we do. But my point is simply that the legal system would be a sufficient incentive for a morality that said, I should do this as long as I don't get caught. Because if I'm caught, the legal system will make me pay. But let me ask you this. Why should I do the good deed in the dark? Why should I do a good deed when I'm never going to be caught?
Okay. The answer to that is because it's not enough to fake and pretend being a moral person. Because in the evolutionary environment of our Paleolithic ancestors, where there were these small groups of a couple dozen to a couple hundred people, everybody is either related to one another or knows one another very good, like any small town. Gossip spreads the information about who's moral and who's not. In time, if you are an opportunistic Machiavellian, you will be caught. People will know this guy is not to be trusted. In a huge anonymous society, like since we've lived in for the last 7,000 years or so, it's too easy to hide. So you need those codified rules. It just so happens that the first two organizations on the scene were government and religion. And they did the best they could to sort of make that happen. But what I'm saying, back then, when we spent 99% of our evolutionary history, was in these small states, you really had to be moral, not fake it, not in the dark, I'm not going to obey the rules. Because if you don't believe it yourself, let me rephrase it, by believing it yourself, actually living it, doing it, and believing it, by actually really being a good person, most of the time, being a moral person, that's the best way to convince other people you're moral, to actually be moral. So I think we evolved a deep moral sentiment. And I think Christianity got it right, the same way Darwin did. We have a, if you want to call it a sinful side or whatever you want to call it, we have a dark, evil, nasty side. We're tribal and xenophobic, all those things. And given the chance, people often do the wrong thing. So that's why we need those rules. So to that extent, I think we're on the same page of our human nature, our sinful nature, good and evil. The only question is where to come from.
Right. So let's begin with a point of agreement, and then I will point out where you go wrong. The point of agreement is that the Darwinian picture of human nature and the Christian picture of human nature are quite similar. They both posit a selfishness built into human nature. And so I contrast both with what I want to call the liberal view of human nature, which is the benign view of human nature, that we have a sort of inner angel that will point us to doing the right thing in every case, that our human nature is in its essence good. I think we agree that we're dealing with the crooked timber of humanity. The problem I see it is this. I have a 12-year-old daughter. I want to teach her to do a lot of good things. For example, don't tell lies. If I were to say to her, honey, I don't think you should tell lies because your ape-like ancestors discovered that faking morality wasn't good enough. Not only should she look at me odd, but she would have a very crushing rebuttal. She would say to me, if this is part of my Darwinian programming, Dad, why do you have to teach it to me? I'm that way anyway. I already know built into my genes that I shouldn't tell lies. You don't need moral instruction here. This is part of my Darwinian nature. I would suggest no, our everyday human experience is not that. On the contrary, it is that left to its own devices, this Darwinian, or I would say Christian, human nature will wreck society and wreck the world. And this is why we have institutions, legal systems, moral instruction, universities, schools, to ultimately inculcate in young people something that doesn't come now. If morality is doing what comes naturally, we would not have to mention the subject at all. Any more than you don't have to tell me when I'm asleep to breathe. I can do that on my own.
If men were angels, we wouldn't need government. Yes, of course. So my answer is this, that most of the time, most people want to and do the right thing. The fact that the Enrons of the world and these kinds of events happen make the news and make spectacular news is because they are still relatively rare. As long as we have a rule of law in a society, and we need that because those informal rules of engagement and conflict resolution that work reasonably well in hunter-gatherer communities where everybody knows one another and the tribal elders sit down with everybody and parents cultivate the moral sentiments within their children and so on. All that works fine without writing anything down as long as it's pretty small. Once you're up into the thousands, there's too many ways to have violations. Okay? So the point of government and society and so on is because there's just too many people. So there is where religion sometimes does good, and I think Christianity figured out most of the major, like all the religions, not Christianity, Judaism really gets the credit for that, figuring out why too much gossip is dangerous, why infidelities, why violations of business contracts and friendships and so on. They figured out what's in our nature already, and since we can't ever settle on where it ultimately comes from, then we can't agree. And I guess the other answer to the question is, what would I tell my daughter? I have a 16-year-old, so I've had these sorts of conversations with her. And no, I don't give her the primate lecture, even though she's heard that in other contexts.
That's a rebuttal.
You just really start with the golden fundamentals of the golden rule, and you know, how would you feel? She had kind of hurt her friend's feeling a few months ago, and I had to talk to her about this. And how would you feel if she had done that to you? And you just kind of basic stuff like that. And they get that.
But let me press you on this a little bit, and maybe as a transition to my turn. So can I pick up after that? Okay.
All right. I'm sorry to interrupt, but there's a lot of people chomping at the bit to ask you guys some questions too.
Okay, well, I haven't had my turn, and I can keep it brief.
Okay, yeah.
Just one or two knockout punches should do it. I'm joking.
All right.
When we talk about, Michael, when we talk about morality, you're speaking as if you've got these human problems and religions have sort of come up with their own stuff. When I look at a set of moral rules, and I want to take, for an example, the UN Charter of Human Rights, a very specific set of 20 or so propositions. We have human dignity, the rights against torture, and it goes down the list. The right to marry and form a family, the right to practice. All right. Now, what's interesting is, although this is the UN Declaration of Universal Rights, I think you would agree with me that these rights are not only not universally respected, they are not universally even cherished in most of the world's cultures and religions. In other words, these so-called human or universal rights are the specific property and were defended as the specific legacy of Christianity universalized. So my point is, this is not a case of a society, this is a case of something Christian in origin and universal in application, but I don't see the idea of universal human dignity in Hinduism or in Buddhism. Do you?
I'm not a big fan of the UN, so we're probably in agreement there. I think the American experiment is the right way to go. The pathway we've been going down, in which our founding fathers, who for the most part were deists, not Christians, came up with this brilliant idea that no matter what religion you are, or even if you're not even religious, and even if you're an atheist, these are still the values we hold dear, which they got from Locke and Rousseau and so forth.
Well, no. Wait, they didn't get them from Locke. Locke may have articulated, but they said that they got them. All men are created equal and endowed by their creator.
Well, it says that in the Declaration of Independence, God does not appear in the Constitution.
That's true, but the Constitution is, if you will, the legal document that reflects the moral proposition of the Declaration.
Yes.
In other words, what is the source of the rights? Where would an inalienable right come from if not from God? Because all my rights that I possess are alienable, right? I own the right to my own labor, but I can sell it. Why can't I sell myself if I want to?
Mm-hmm.
Don't I own me?
Because we said so.
We?
Yeah.
He?
Yeah, well
whoever
he is.
Okay.
Or she.
Whoever he,
yeah.
He or she, and maybe the commandment came to Salt Lake City, but
I mean,
my point is, where does it come from? Is it not a transcendent principle?
I think it is transcendent.
Can you give
even
an evolutionary explanation for it?
Even without a God, it's still transcendent.
It is still transcendent.
I think so.
Okay.
By saying so.
Let me push you on this line of reasoning. I want to pick up with Darwin here. You said earlier that religion, it would be nice if it is true, And here I see you picking up an old tradition. We see it in Freud and Marx. The idea of religion is wish fulfillment, right? The idea that you wish it was true, and that's kind of why a lot of people believe. I want to suggest this. Wish fulfillment cannot survive Darwinian analysis because it can't be in our human interest to believe things that are manifestly untrue. Imagine the case of a rabbit being pursued by a lion. The rabbit says, I could run, but I shall not. There is another life waiting for me that is even better than this one. What would happen to such a rabbit? It would be promptly eaten. Rabbits that believed in afterlives would not survive. Therefore, what is the Darwinian explanation for wish fulfillment?
The premise, I don't agree with the premise, because I don't accept it.
Just a second. If you'll answer this question, Ness is harder than anybody in the audience I've had to deal with before.
So I'm going to have to go ahead and just put the kibosh on this after you give a brief answer to this, if you will, please.
Okay.
I was just getting started.
I know, we're revving up.
That's fine.
You can have a few more minutes in the Q&A. I don't even buy the wish fulfillment explanation for religion. I don't think it's wish fulfillment, so I don't think it needs a Darwinian explanation. I think religion has its origins in other sources, and it's a big complex thing, as we've been talking about tonight. There's not a single explanation for religion. So I disagree with all my evolution friends.
May I pose one more question?
Wait, you said that a minute ago.
It's okay with me if you ask one more.
Well, okay. Actually, in fact, this discussion is fairly rich, and I do wish to be dynamic in this. So I know that a lot of folks are chomping at the bit, like I said earlier, to ask questions, but maybe if, by a raise of hands, if you would tell me if you would rather them continue for 2 more minutes or to jump right to questions. Raise your hands if you wish to continue for 2 more minutes.
Okay.
All right. Give
me another one.
Thank you.
Bring it on.
It's Shermer and D'Souza against the moderator at this point. Okay. You said something that, on the surface of it, would be a little troubling to a believer, that by measures of social pathology, Christians, to put it in religious language, commit more sins than non-Christians. If you look at social pathologies, you find that states that are secular, like Massachusetts, have lower rates of divorce than states like Mississippi that are more religious. I think that's true. And actually, I think that may suggest something very interesting about religion, which is that it draws people who feel that there is something broken in their life that needs to be fixed. The Bible is very consistent with this, the idea that the broken person is more likely to recognize the need for repair than the guy who's doing great. I think this is why the Bible says that it's hard for the rich guy to get to heaven, because the rich guy feels, I'm doing great. And so it doesn't surprise me entirely that broken people lean to Christianity. But I want to ask you this question. Would you not agree that the secular values that we find, for example, in Europe, the secular values we would find in Massachusetts, have themselves a Christian root? Here's what I mean. You made jokes earlier about pedophilia and so on. If I read, I was talking earlier in my own speech about how we see Athens through the eyes of Jerusalem. You only have to go back and look at Athens without Jerusalem to realize that not just homosexuality, but pederasty was a normal part of life in Athens. And in fact, in Plato's Symposium, one of the characters even defends it, and all he defends it, he thinks that pedophilia is a little unfair to the older guy. This is the character. So what I'm getting at here is this. Isn't it true that the secular so-called values that you appeal to show the deficiency of the Christians, are themselves Christian? In other words, that Europe, although pagan perhaps or atheist in its current practice, is still inhabiting a culture formed by Christianity. See, this was the point the philosopher Nietzsche made. He said, Western man thinks that you can kill God and keep everything else. You can kill God and keep Christian morality, keep equality, keep the idea of the family, keep the idea of compassion. Nietzsche said no. He said, you remove the foundation And the rest of it will stay for a while, a decade, a century, by habit, but eventually it'll start crumbling. And I would suggest that as our society has become more secular, we do see values newly introduced by Christianity, for example, the respect for human life, begin to erode at the edges. I mean, today no one would justify mass killing, but on the other hand, would it surprise you totally if 30 years from now people felt that once you are weak and frail and cannot support yourself, you have a duty to die? I can see a value like that creeping back into our society. If so, it would reflect the delayed legacy of the death of God, according to Nietzsche. So here's my point. How do you expect to preserve Christian morality without Christianity?
Okay. Well, that's a two-part question. The first part on the Paul study that I cited that you referenced. So I'll take off my debater's hat for a minute and put on my social science hat. It's not clear which way the causal vector goes, whether extreme religiosity in developed democracies leads to more STDs and abortions and so on, or whether those societal ills, perhaps driven by economic problems, and then those economic problems, let's say great disparity between wealth and poverty, leads more people to become religious, particularly on the lower economic strata, and that's what leads to this increase in religiosity. So this is what my liberal social science friends think is the explanation for that study, is that because America is not only so, it's very religious, but there's also a huge, great disparity between the rich and the poor, and our safety net for those who fall through the cracks is not very good. Although conservatives think it's getting worse, it's going in the wrong direction. But nevertheless, so it's not clear to me which way the causal arrow goes. But whatever religion does, apparently it is not controlling for those sorts of things. Now, I'll give you a point that Hitchens makes in his book that he'll probably bring up if you ask him that question, and that is, even to the extent that parts of Christianity throughout history have gotten us to a certain level, the fact that we rode there on a horse doesn't mean we can't get off the horse and now start driving a car. That is, the vehicles that gets you somewhere, that may just be true, but that doesn't mean we have to keep using that. So why not take the parts of Christianity and Judaism and all the other religions that we see have value, dump the ridiculous stuff, stoning to death, disobedient children, all these other idiotic stories that we would no longer ever embrace today, and then move on and use the best we can, do the best we can. We're all on this journey together.
I don't think you have to resort to secularism to be able to see that even within morality there is development. In other words, I think there's nothing in Christianity that denies the idea of moral progress. Moral progress would basically refer to not the invention of a new principle, but a widening franchise of its application. And so, for example, the founders say all men are created equal, but that applies in a very narrow way. In the Civil War, that orbit is extended, and slavery is abolished. In the Civil Rights Movement, another religious movement again, and again, a fairly recent one. My point is not necessarily the person, that the fact that Martin Luther King was a minister or something like that. It's rather that his argument is, in and of its nature, moral and religious.
So wasn't Gandhi his role model?
Yeah, but, it was, but Gandhi got his own concept of nonviolence from Thoreau, and in other words, Gandhi himself leaned on Jesus and Thoreau, so you have a very interesting symbiosis here.
Right, so you take parts of this religion and parts of this religion, and the culture moves forward. This sort of cultural zeitgeist continues to progress. Religion's part of it, sometimes it contributes, sometimes it doesn't. Secularity sometimes contributes, sometimes doesn't. And we're just trying to struggle to do the best we can. Well, I guess
we agree on all this.
What we're trying to do, I think, is we're trying to take the in-group and make it so big that there's no longer any out-group members. Because that's the problem. We try to leave.
That notion of the in-group...
Dinesh.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Might the moderator be respected?
Yeah.
Okay.
All right. Thank you.
Absolutely.
Let's go.
Okay, sure. And in fact, this is quite a bit longer than I intended to go, but I appreciate you all expressing your opinion on where to go with it. At this point, though, I would like to take questions from the audience. Prior to doing so, and as you approach the microphone, please see that you adhere to what I request of you. Firstly, I do ask that you take time to carefully frame your question. Often writing it down helps. And please, in fact, I will cut you off if you continue dialogue. I will force you to obey the moderator. And so, with that being said, just one question. Please carefully frame it. And we do not permit statements. This is, of course, time for the scholars to speak and you to ask the questions. So, please, the microphones are at the front. Approach the front if you have a question, and I will call on you to ask the question.
Is this on?
Yeah, he'll turn it on. Go ahead. I think he'll start talking.
Okay. Alan?
Yep.
Yeah, first of all, I really do want to say that I'm an atheist for Jesus and spent 13 and a half years in the Bible Belt in Upper East Tennessee, and I can guarantee you that the Christians are relatively intolerant of atheists in that area, having lost friends after they found out I was an atheist. During the time of Jesus in Jerusalem, there was a lot of Jewish people who were fighting one another. And in fact, part of the reason I would consider myself an atheist for Jesus is Jesus was living in this time, and if you listen to what he says that in Matthew 23, he talks about the Pharisees, and these, of course, were Jewish people. So the pillars of Judaism out of which this come were people who were killing each other inside the walled cities in Jerusalem, and Jesus was really upset with the pillars of Judaism at that time. And
sir, please, if you could get to the question, I appreciate it.
Okay, so I want to ask you, with that sort of trouble in mind, and the fact that Hitler himself was really a Christian, you know, how do you look at the Christian religion in some parts of it, which have caused great trouble, and the Christian religion, which in other parts, has done well in the world?
Since my position on the Atheist for Jesus movement is one of mere mystification, I will zoom in to your proposition that Hitler was a Christian. You should read a book called Hitler's Table Talk, which is an extended discussion of Hitler's private statements, recorded diaries of Hitler as kept by his closest aides. Those are important because Hitler was in a largely Lutheran and partially Catholic country. Initially, Hitler tried to cut a deal with the churches, failed, and then relentlessly persecuted them. But you see from Hitler's Table Talk that he was very clearly a pagan. And by a pagan, what I mean is an atheist of this sort. The ancient pagans believed in Zeus and Baal. They believed in those gods. Hitler's paganism was secular. Ultimately, Hitler's commitment was to a racial ideology that was secular in nature, that sought to destroy the power of religion because he saw that power of religion as a competing force in society. You should read Richard Weikart's book, From Darwin to Hitler. The roots of Nazism were in two strains of thought. On the one hand, a social Darwinism, and on the other hand, a Nietzschean strain that exalted the Superman. I do not for one second think that Darwin or Nietzsche would have approved of Hitler. My point is that the Nazis approved of them and drew on the secular strains in order to concoct a fantastic and destructive ideology that first of all targeted the Jews, not for religious reasons, but for racial reasons, and the churches, which were the second target in Hitler's sights.
In fact, thank you for the question. I'm sorry. Dr. Sherman, would you care to?
My response is that, as I said, people are tribal and xenophobic and nasty in certain circumstances, and I think religion or no religion, political leaders will be land grabbers and so forth. I think atheism, theism is irrelevant. If all that was gone, dictators would still rise, people would still try to get power, I think that's my opinion. Thank you.
Okay, I have a question for you. Just really quickly, is your daughter, is she a Christian? Does she believe in God?
She's a Christian, she believes in God.
Okay. Let's say that she grows up to be a teenager and really strongly has a strong faith for God. But what if she became attracted to women because that's how she truly felt? How would you feel? Do you think that God would really not love her, or do you feel that you would lose some love for her?
I would answer to go both those questions, no.
Can I answer that for you? That's what I'm going to talk about.
Pardon?
Can I answer that for you?
You want to answer it for me?
No.
You can answer it for yourself. I'm not sure where you're going with this, but I would say no. I don't believe I would lose any love for her, and I don't think God would either.
Well, the reason I ask
again, I'm sorry. Please, just ask your question, and it's not really time to dialogue.
Do you love the sinner but hate the sin?
I mean, I try to not let my. I think there's something in our nature that loves good and dislikes evil. That's not just me. I think we all feel this way. The revolutionary aspect of Christianity is not to say that. Aristotle would have agreed. In fact, Aristotle says it is impossible to love a bad man, because how can you love badness in a man? Christ gives a different answer, and that is, Christ says, don't stop hating the badness, but love the man anyway. So you're turning a love doctrine into a hate doctrine. The love doctrine is the doctrine that separates the sin from the sinner to keep... Instead of saying, here's a man who did bad things, I'm going to strike a compromise. I'm going to not dislike the badness so much, because it's, after all, a good guy. Christ says, no, dislike the badness completely, but then also love the guy completely. I mean, that seems to me to be a beautiful doctrine that separates the bad action from the inner worth of the person.
Thank you.
Next question. Right, my question is directed towards Dr. Shore. And as a Christian male, as a Christian male, I like that you brought the Bible up. I mean, this is on homosexuality. I find revealed in the Bible that mankind, that I myself am fallen, that all of nature, all of creation is fallen. And so therefore, I'm unable to look at it as an example to put out the premise of how I should live, or what I should do, or what is normal. That God has revealed himself and revealed that I was created for a woman, and that woman was created for man, and that in my revelation of him being my creator, I out of love respond to his purpose for me.
If you could get to your question, please.
My question for you is, how do you see there being able to have a as you said, that homosexuality someday will be a part of the church, when very clearly the whole issue of homosexuality in the church is that it is outside of the purpose of the Creator, of the purpose of the creation, that we can never reconcile those two, because it's been, as a Christian, I believe it's been stated that is not our purpose.
Well, I was pretty clear on this. You're basing this entirely on one single passage.
No, Romans 1:20-27 talks about the corruptible nature of mankind, of man, but even of creation.
That, no, I'm just talking
to
like
say that it's
animal homosexuality.
Well, look
at as a sin.
All right, let Dr. Shore.
I mean, you're basing this entire thing on this one passage that homosexuality is a man shall not lie with a man. That's it, Leviticus. That's all you get.
Try reading.
It won't say that. I don't consider homosexuality bad. What's bad about it? If you get married to a woman, how does some other same-sex couple? How does that hurt you? What do you care what they do? These are consenting adults. We're not talking about polygamous 13-year-olds and 50-year-old guys. Just consenting adults. What do you care what they do in their bedroom? Why is that your business? Mind your own business.
I'm going to have to cut you off, but thank you for your question. Would you care?
Well, I have a thought, but I'll come back to it. In the interest of time, I don't mind moving on.
Over here, on my right. Okay, you stated that the worldview of rationality derived from Christianity. Could you explain further exactly how that developed from Christianity? You didn't explain that.
The question is about how did we get this sort of idea of a rational universe from Christianity? The idea of the rational universe was actually first thought of by the pre-Socratics. The pre-Socratics, if you go back to Thales and so on, they had this sort of idea that the universe is in some ways coherent. Look at Thales, he says, everything is water. Now, if you think about it, this is crazy. How can everything be water? But what Thales is saying is behind the superficial diversity of the world, there is a kind of single entity, namely water. He was wrong about what the entity was, but he had a kind of insight, which is that perhaps there is an underlying something that explains the manifest diversity of everything. So the pre-Socratics were onto something, but in a sense, Socrates came along and said, listen, guys, you're talking too much about nature. Let's talk about human nature. And we see a big shift in philosophy away from nature and toward human nature. In the medieval era, this notion of the rational universe is picked up, but it's given a much deeper and more elaborate foundation. And the idea here is that the universe is rational because God is not only omnipotent, which is powerful, but omniscient. Omniscient means all-knowing. So the universe is going to reflect to some degree. The creation will reflect the Creator. The universe shows those traces or signatures of divine rationality. This is what the medieval Christians believed. You can read it in Augustine, you can read it in Boethius, you can read it in many of the medieval thinkers. And that's why you have the invention of theology. Theology is an effort to give rational meaning to the universe. If you go into Islam, you don't find an equivalent to theology. Even in Judaism, you have jurisprudence, Maimonides, the disputations of the meaning of the Torah, but nothing resembling Christian theology to use human reason to intuit the purposes of God in the rational universe. What I'm getting at is the medieval Christians developed this edifice. And modern science didn't grow out of a rebellion against Christianity, it grew out of a debate within two strains within Christianity. My new book, What's So Great About Christianity, traces this history. There was an inductive strain in theology, and then there was a deductive strain. You can think of Aquinas as reflecting the inductive, and you can think of Anselm as reflecting the deductive. You see this even in their arguments for God's existence. Modern science draws on that tradition to develop the idea of the rational universe, and the scientists saw themselves as physicians. I mean, Copernicus was a deacon in the cathedral and said, I wanted to become a theologian, but I became an astronomer pretty much for the same reason, to demonstrate the rationality of God in the universe. There's a whole literature on this. Newton wrote more on scripture than he wrote about science, and he hadn't read Richard Dawkins' book, I guess. He didn't know that these two things were totally contradictory. Sure.
Yeah. I think that chapter in your book is one of the best. It's the best chapter in your book on the Galileo stuff. But you didn't take it far enough. Yes, the rational world comes from these two strands, Athens and Jerusalem, let's say. I think you got all that right from a historian of science point of view. But in the middle of the scientific revolution, you talked about Galileo and Kepler and Copernicus, but there was also William Harvey and Vesalius and Gilbert on magnets and so on. What it was a battle of the books, the book of nature and the book of authority. The book of authority was both Athens and Jerusalem. It was Aristotle and Aquinas. And what the scientific revolution was revolting against was that if you actually go out into nature and look to see if it really is that way, whether the authority comes from church or from a secular source like Athens or Jerusalem, it doesn't matter. We still have to go out and check. It's the empirical nature of science that I think is so revolutionary.
May I ask just a very brief thought about Galileo, because it illuminates this whole controversy. See, today when we read the Galileo thing, we think, oh, Galileo was right, the church was wrong. I would submit that this is what can be called a retroactive fallacy. We know today that we live in a heliocentric system. We know today that Galileo was right. That was not known in Galileo's time. The best astronomers in the world did not agree with Galileo. Galileo made arguments for the heliocentric system, but his arguments were often wrong. He thought that you could prove the fact that the Earth moved around the sun by looking at the tides. He actually had a completely wrong understanding of heliocentrism. When he came before Cardinal Bellarmine, Cardinal Bellarmine said to Galileo, what I consider to be an eminently reasonable scientific statement. He said, Galileo, you could be right. He said, but the fact is, we don't know. The evidence is inconclusive. If you can show me a demonstrative proof that the Earth goes around the sun, I think it is only reasonable for the church to admit that we have been understanding Scripture in the wrong way. There is no possibility that the book of nature and the book of Scripture can be in conflict. So if you show me real proofs that you're right, we will revise our interpretation of the Bible in line with your demonstrations. But since you don't have these demonstrations underlined, therefore we are in a position that it is better to preserve the ancient teaching until the evidence comes into the contrary. This, I would suggest, is an absolutely sensible model, not only of church doctrine, but of pedagogy. You're teaching something, it's been established for a long time, common sense supports it. In other words, when you throw an object in the air, if the earth is moving at thousands of miles an hour, it would seem to land at a different spot. So it wasn't just that the Bible said, human evidence seemed to support Ptolemy. The Galileo controversy shows us, if we will read it modestly, that there's a lot of arrogance on both sides. This was a case where ultimately Galileo was vindicated, but only a generation later. That's when the evidence did come in, and that's when Galileo was shown to be correct.
That was one heck of a question. I appreciate that for two reasons. One, it was terse, and two, it brought about such a book on this end of things. Please make your questions equally terse if you can. Next question.
Mr. Shermer, you said repeatedly that the Bible only says that homosexuality is wrong in one passage.
Okay, well, maybe there's
a correct.
Whatever. Yeah.
Well, no, not whatever. It's important to be factually correct in a debate, is it not?
I don't care. If there's two places or three places, it says stoning to death.
So were you factually correct or were you not factually correct? Have you ever read the document in its entirety?
The Bible, yeah, yeah.
Let's
anyway, go ahead.
I
don't care if it says executing adulterers 27 times. That's okay. Still wrong.
Let's not.
You brought it up, so
that
the question is
enough.
So were you also aware that about the surest way to reduce...
I'm sorry, sir. I'm going to have to interrupt you.
Did you know that?
Dr. Shermer, please... You don't have to respond to that. This is not a time for dialogue, sir. I'm sorry, but I think he can respond to your first question.
Wait, he did get a question.
And let's leave it there.
That the surest way to reduce your life expectancy is to be gay. One of the surest ways.
That's it. I'm sorry, sir.
Actually, the surest way is...
check it out.
...is smoking.
Okay.
So, there's somewhere in the Bible that says that's going to smoke.
Well...
Let me give a better answer than that. It doesn't matter if it says it once, twice, three times. Why is it wrong?
Mike, I'm going to come to your defense here in this way. We're seeing here a little bit of the difficulty of having a debate like this one, and I think it's this, and that is that sometimes those of us who are Christians... resort to what can be called a biblical language in trying to defend propositions. Now, that is useful if you are talking in a Christian community which accepts the authority of Scripture to adjudicate the question. The problem is when you come into a secular audience where you can't say, it doesn't matter if the Bible says it 100 times, Mike Shermer's point is, I don't accept the authority of the Bible to decide the question. And I think what this means is that while I would like to see atheists and secular people have more respect for religious people and for Christianity, I would like to see Christians, on the other hand, realize that you have to make arguments in secular terms that appeal to common reason and evidence and don't simply resolve an issue by saying the Bible says so.
Next question, please.
I'm just curious. I'm a follower of Christ. And my question for Dr. Schumer is, how do you associate Mormonism with Christianity when many Christians feel it is a cult?
Yes, that's true. Many Christians do think Mormons are practicing a cult. Mormons don't think so. Any more than Episcopalians think they're members of a cult. So this is part of that divisive in-group, out-group thing that... I mean, Mormons accept Christ as their Savior, that He died for their sins, John 3:16, for God so loved the world He gave His own begotten Son, and so forth. They accept all that. So, again, what do you care if they wear weird underwear? You're going to call them a cult because they wear different underwear? I mean, this is part of the problem that I see with Christianity. You know, whether you baptize somebody as an infant or an adult, and we're going to kill each other until we settle this question. This is not good. That's one of the dark sides of Christianity.
Thank you for your question. Next question, please.
My question is for both of you. It's a personal question. What is the foundational basis for knowing something? If you would like, possibly you could give a personal example of how that works.
Knowing something about the natural world, you mean? Or the moral world? Or
any sort of appeal to knowledge? What could you perhaps boil that down to you? What is the foundational basis for knowing something?
You want to go?
Somewhat like the mosquito in the nudist colony. I'm trying to decide where to begin. But look, let me say, I would put it this way. I think that the atheist and the theist travel opposite journeys. In a way, Mike Sherman and I have a lot in common. We were both raised in a Christian household. And the difference between us, I think, is that Shermer rebelled once against the Christianity in which he was raised. And I would describe my own rebellion as a double rebellion. I rebelled against the Christianity in which I was raised when I went to school, when I went to college. And I saw it as a little bit of a juvenile set of beliefs. But later in life, I came to realize that the reason I had those juvenile beliefs is that I was taught that Christianity when I was 5 and when I was 10. The university assault was not against Christianity. It was against the 10-year-old version of it that I brought to Dartmouth as an undergraduate. Christianity in that form could not be defended. And so, for example, if my parents taught me that there is a sharp line between good and evil, I came to college and I realized much in life is really gray. And I also realized that the line between good and evil is not between us and them, or even between the believer and the atheist. It runs in every human heart. But the older I've gotten, the more I've realized that this primordial distinction between good and evil is, in fact, a very valid one. The world makes a lot more sense if you don't just look for gray, but realize that the fact of twilight is really made possible by day and night. So in other words, in adult life, I have had, you know, what I call the second sailing, Plato's term. The first sailing is the sort of innocent Christianity that can easily be assaulted because it's held in a very crayon-like form. And now a second type of Christianity, much more rooted in evidence and science and an appreciation for the wonder of the natural world, a Christianity at home in modern scholarship. Those are the themes I defend in this book, What's So Great About Christianity. It's not the Christianity, if you will, that I was taught as a child, but it is bringing a mature adult intelligence to bear on it. That's the way I look at my own journey.
Dr. Sherman, would you like to respond?
Yeah, well, I think I'm a real pragmatist and empiricist. I think science is the best tool ever developed to understand the world simply because it works so well. If you want to get a spacecraft to Mars, you use astronomy, not astrology. If you want to develop chemicals, you use chemistry, not alchemy. We use the best techniques of medicine rather than whatever the alternative would be, alternative medicine. So,
well, Mike, may I ask you a question on this? Moderator, will you permit a question between us?
Yes.
Okay.
Quickly.
We totally agree on this. You're saying that within the empirical world, science is supreme. I agree. So if somebody were to claim, I'm cured by a miracle, I would agree with you. We use the normal techniques of science to figure out if that's true. In fact, the Catholic Church believes that. They hire doctors to figure out if people who say they were cured miraculously were in fact cured. Here's my question. How do you decide a question that is not resolvable empirically? For example, if somebody said, what happens to you after death? Or is there a God? What kind of evidence are you looking for that would convince you?
I don't think there is any.
There is any. So it doesn't matter what the nature of, even if you saw planets that said, Yahweh made this, signed God, you would not believe. You would say that that was a chance assembly of atoms. True?
I think there are certain questions in life that our brains are big enough to ask but not answer, and they're largely dependent on the use of words and language. So free will and determinism, how can you reconcile these if we define them in a certain way? They're irreconcilable. If you tweak the definitions, then you can somehow meld them together. And I think the God question, the immortality question, and the free will question are in that category of not answerable by the tools of science. We can use reason and philosophy to get to a certain level, and then we bump up against the unknown. And for me, it's okay to just say, I don't know. We don't have to have an answer for everything. Most of us are uncomfortable with ambiguity. We all are. And so it takes a little bit of extra effort to say, it's okay to just leave that open for now. We'll find out later.
But why is it okay? Here's why. It makes a great difference to us the way we live now, if we have an immortal soul or no. In other words, if we don't have an immortal soul, I would live differently than if we did.
I wouldn't.
You would live exactly the same way. It would make no difference. Let me suggest.
If you turned out that you didn't believe in God, you're not going to start raping and pillaging.
No, that's not what I mean. That's not what I mean. What I mean is that, in some ways, the most fundamental questions of life, in other words, is there a divine supervision of the universe? Is there life after death? I think glibly you could say, yeah, I would still wake up in the morning, eat my breakfast, and pat my daughter on the head. I don't mean that. I mean, wouldn't the world be a very different place if we were to extirpate these ideas of free will, the immortality of the soul, the transcendent? I mean, one of the reasons I think there's anxiety about Darwinism, to be honest. And I'm an evolutionist. I'm not a defender of creationism or any of that nonsense. But I would say that I am a little uneasy about the idea that man is purely a material being. I do think that that would do something to debase man if we were to all see ourselves as purely material and merely acting out our evolutionary urges and accountable, ultimately, to no higher power. My question is, these are very important questions. You say they're scientifically undecidable, but then when you say you're not deciding them, I would argue you are. By maintaining an open mind on a question on which you can't possibly close it, you're not being open-minded. You are dogmatically closing yourself off to a possibility that might well be real. You might well die and discover that there is, but you refuse to be open to that possibility now. Why?
I'll tell you what, if there is a planet that we discover that says Yahweh made this, I will reconsider my position.
Well, at least you're a true empiricist.
Short of that, I just can't conceive of how we can test that. Because let's say we discover that DNA was designed by some extraterrestrials instead of coming from RNA or whatever. All that would do would be push off the causal level one level. Okay, that's interesting that the Vegans made it or whatever, but who made them? And so on. We go all the way back. How would you know whether God was made by another God or that was the final cause? At that point, we're in philosophy, we're using language a certain way, and we're off the page of science.
Dinesh, if you don't mind.
We'll move on.
I'd like to let the audience continue.
Sure.
While I appreciate your dialogue, again, actually, over here, please.
I'd like to know where do we go from here? How would each of your respective positions direct us in 10, 100, 1,000 years from now should the other position wither and die?
Well, I don't think it's likely religion's going to wither and die anytime soon. The polls show we're going the other way. And I don't think it matters. As long as we follow the principle of liberty, that we respect other people's freedom to believe or disbelieve whatever they want, and just keep, you know, pushing forward that way.
I think that there is, particularly within the intelligentsia, a prejudice against Christianity. To some degree, I even share it. And what I mean by that is that the Christianity that we rebel against, and it was the Christianity that Voltaire rebelled against, was a Christianity that, because of the circumstances of Western history, linked throne and altar. It was a Christianity that became part of monarchy. It became part of the powers that be. That was the Christianity that carried out the Inquisition, and we are all rightly suspicious of it. I want to suggest that that isn't Christianity. In other words, Christianity as a universal system is going to, if you will, meld with whatever social, political, institutional arrangements are there. If Christianity existed in a socialist society, you'd have Christian socialism. If it's in a capitalist society, you'll have a Christian argument for free markets. So we should separate out things here. Just like sometimes people say, capitalism is selfish. No. Not capitalism that's selfish. The selfishness is in human nature. Capitalism steers it in such a way that it's in a way to try to make it promote the public good. In the same way that lust is in human nature. Marriage is intended to civilize lust and steer it to the raising of the next generation. So my point here is that I would like to see the prejudice that we have against, you can say, ancient Christianity and against the Christianity that's within us, but it's an adolescent Christianity. We should look at Christianity with fresh eyes, apply it to our lives today, and that's my point. I have at no point in this debate appealed to blind faith. I've appealed to the same reason as Sharma. We're arguing on the same basis. My point is that Christianity, at the end of the day, makes better sense of our world than a secular point of view that ultimately has things and can't explain them. Here's the universe. We know it had a beginning. Where did it come from? We don't know, but we'll explain later. This is what I call the atheism of the gaps. When we can't figure it out, atheism did it. We don't want the God of the gaps, but neither can we assume that if something is unexplained, it's going to be.
I'm going to interrupt before this next question, and I know that you patient folks who have been waiting there in the aisles for a while or may attempt to stone me, but I'm going to allow, unfortunately, one more question, and I really appreciate your patience. And at that point, we're going to let the speakers close, and then if the audience has enough patience, please bear with me for a few closing remarks. But
this guy's buying his place in line.
I am a God in this country. Adolf Hitler is a God in this country. I want to know why it is that when Donald Rumsfeld goes to Stratford, this man doesn't stay back there and concern himself with the work of Satan, but comes here and talks about God.
Thank you, sir.
Now, how much are we being paid to hear that?
actually, with the next questioner, please proceed with your question.
So, we'll explain that later. So I was born an atheist in the sense that I didn't know anything about God. I was baptized a Catholic. I was reborn a Christian. And today I'm an anti-theist. So with that being said, I have seen much good from man, but very little from God. If I am forced, or if I have to make a decision to place my faith somewhere, I choose to place it in reason. And excuse the reference to the deity, but thank God that I have the freedom of choice. There are, in Psalms 14 and 53, identical verses, both starting with the same, the fool hath said, in his heart there is no God. And yet in Matthew 5:22, but whoever so saith, thou fool, shall be in danger of hellfire.
Would you please jump right to the question?
There's two questions on it. Is there
one
reason?
Question.
Is there a reason for that remark that makes it considered so significant that it needs to be repeated in many, many different flavors and forms in there? And on the other side of it, they say that the road is narrow and that the horizon is wide and that what is waiting for us on the other side is so rewarding and the ultimate prize.
Sir,
what good is something if you can't have it until you die?
Thank you. Thank you for your question.
I guess that's for you.
Very briefly, I would answer this. I think the reason the Bible uses the term the fool here is it's not so much a charge of ignorance as it is a charge of pride. In other words, the idea here is that look how easy it is. You say you believe in reason. I believe in reason. We both believe in science. Science says that we are material beings. We are the product of physical laws. We are made up of physical matter. I agree with all that. And yet, looking at experience itself, not to heaven, I see dimensions of my human nature that seem inexplicable in the terms of materiality and deterministic explanation. To wit, here is a pen. I have the free choice of holding it or dropping it. If I drop it, its trajectory is totally determined by the laws of physics. But my decision to drop it is totally mine. I can go either way. You don't want to make a guess? You don't know. And the laws of physics don't either. My point is, the idea of the ghost in the machine is not some weird invention. It is practically supported by the empirical reality of free choice in the world. We could not live in the world if every day we don't make decisions that are free decisions. Morality would make no sense. You should never say to someone, you should not do that.
Based on whose morality?
No, sorry, sir. No more questions.
I'm not discussing relativism here. I am refuting the simple materialism that says that I am completely determined by the laws of nature. I'm saying that experience itself points to a ghost in the machine, a dimension of human nature that is not merely an extension of the laws of science, that involves what Kant calls the noumenal realm. And I'm appealing to experience and reason and science and philosophy to point to it.
Can I give up my... I have a short response, but I'm going to give it up, and if it's okay with the moderator, because he's been so patient.
Yes, I think that's fine. This will be the final question.
Yep, you're up.
This is for Dinesh. What, in your opinion, distinguishes Christian assumptions as more valuable than any arbitrary set of assumptions from which we can operate on a system of universality and comprehensibility?
Well, your question in its complexity inspires me the thought that it might have been better to have cut off the questions before you got started. Look, I would apply a couple of thoughts here. One is a biblical principle, but it's also very secular. By their fruits ye shall know them, right? In other words, we judge the validity of an idea by looking at what it has done in the world. So I simply ask myself, just as I would say, what would this world be like if the ancient Greeks had never lived? It would be a much more sordid place, I think, than it is, because they lived. What would Western civilization be like? Let's start moving through it. We'd have to take away the Dante. We'd have to take away Milton. We'd have to take away Raphael, Michelangelo. So not just at the superficial level, art, literature, and so on, but at the deeper level, we then come to the assumptions that we see distinguishing Western civilization. Take the assumption that every individual human life is precious and equally precious. This, I would argue, is indisputably the legacy of Christianity. And the reason we know it is other cultures haven't shared this value. The Christians defended it, the culture accepted it, even secular people who rebelled against Christianity preserved it. So, now Michael raises an interesting point. Can you kick out the Christianity and keep the value? This is a matter of debate. Nietzsche's answer, no. The reason is, ultimately, when you subtract the foundation, all somebody has to do is ask the question, why? You're not respecting my rights. Why should I expect your rights? But you don't care about me. Precisely. But you're trying to harm me. So what? But you're only doing this for your benefit. Of course, who else's benefit should I look after? So my point is, we don't hear this kind of talk because we are still imbued with Christian assumptions. I grew up in a different culture. I hear it all the time. When you talk about Enron, every Indian business is Enron. Every corruption is normal. You want to get a job, how much are you willing to pay? My point is, the reason we recoil, the reason we write checks, the reason we are horrified, is even at church abuses, is because we are all practical Christians. In other words, we have embraced Christian morality even if we don't embrace the Christian God. So that would be a short answer. It's not a religious answer. I'm giving you a secular answer for the impact Christianity has had in the world. If Christianity had not existed, this would be a very different civilization. Many good things that you value in life would not exist. So life would be more nasty, sordid, brutish, and short. Christianity has made our world better.
Dr. Sherman, would you care to follow that up?
I guess just briefly that where I began, that it's a huge, complex phenomenon, social phenomenon, religion, Christianity, and you can't really separate it in a counterfactual what if there never was Christianity. It's impossible to know. It's so deeply embedded and ingrained, and it's done great things, it's done terrible things, and so on. And here we are on this journey. I guess one of the things I learned the most, I wrote a book on the Holocaust deniers with a Orthodox Jewish historian. And anyway, so we spent a lot of time going around all the camps one summer, all the ex-death camps in Europe. And so I learned a lot about Orthodox Judaism. One of the things, although he wasn't super extreme Orthodox, but one of the things I learned was from him that the commentaries over the centuries, really millennium, by the great Jewish scholars, of which there are hundreds of them, showed me that the sort of the process of debate and disputation was as important, if not more important, than the final answers you end up with. And that it's deeply important to have at least given deep and careful thought to everything you're doing. Maybe even more important than what you end up deciding, that at least you did that. And for that, I really admire Judaism, that is developing that whole process of debate and disputation, and that's what we're doing here.
Mr. D'Souza, would you care to take a moment? If you can keep it short, that'd be great. certainly no longer than 2 minutes for our closing remark.
You know, there's a story that was told about Mother Teresa, and it was that she was in Calcutta hugging a leper. And an Indian guy was passing and looked at her and said, why are you doing that? He said, I would not do that for all the money in the world. And she said to him, I wouldn't either. I'm not doing it for the money in the world. I'm doing it for the love of Christ. Now, I wouldn't deny for a moment that non-religious people can live well and do good things. But I would suggest that the supreme sacrifices that you see in people like Mother Teresa reflect that other dimension. We see from Mother Teresa's diaries that this was actually not even in some ways a reciprocated love. In a sense, she loved God, and she, from her experiential point of view, God didn't love her back. She never felt it for years. And you might say, well, that makes her kind of a doubter. In the sense that, yeah, I'm a doubter too. When Michael Shermer says, I don't know and you don't either, I'm happy to sign on the dotted line. I don't know. If I knew, how could I believe? I wouldn't say I believe in my brother. I know the guy. The reason you believe is because you don't know. So the believer shares with the agnostic the not knowingness. The real difference here, it seems to me, is really this. And it's ultimately that there are questions about life that are beyond the realm of experience. But it is, I think, a very shallow answer to say, since we don't know, we don't decide. We wait until the knowledge comes in only because the knowledge will never, it's sort of like this. I'm in love with a woman. I'm trying to decide whether I should marry her. Now, I'm waiting for the data. What's the data? How will life be like with her for the next 45 years? My point is, it doesn't matter how long we date. I'm never going to know that. I have to decide, do I ask her to marry or no? I even respect the atheist who says no. The agnostic, I'm going to wait till the data comes in. Well, either she'll marry somebody else or you'll both be dead. So my point is, there are things in life which matter to us. We need ultimately to decide if we want to live in a world of mystery and miracle, a world in which the sublime is a part of everyday life, Or do we want to live in a demystified world, a world in which nothing is miraculous? And to me, that world is a little bit grayer, darker, not a world that, in a sense, makes sense of the wonder of our existence. It's ultimately the wonder of our existence, which is, I think, at the root of it, mysterious, that inclines me to the idea of the supernatural. I have no hostility to people who are Jews or Buddhists, because I think they share that sense of transcendence. For me, it is best expressed within Christianity, but for all believers, it is expressed in this idea of something more. So my book, What's So Great About Christianity, written not just for Christians, it is in part to give a secular argument for Christianity, but one that would appeal to all seekers, and I think also as a challenge to atheists. Even atheism requires a kind of skeptical challenge that is skeptical not only of religion, but also skeptical of skepticism. That's what I'm trying to deliver. Thank you.
Good book, by the way. I recommend it. On the other side.
Dr. Sherman, would you care to close the interview?
Yes, I'm going to just read a final couple passages from my book, Why Darwin Matters, the final epilogue. I begin the epilogue with a trip I took to the Esalen Institute in Big Sur, California, which is sort of a hotbed of New Age, Timothy Leary kind of experiences people have, although apparently they don't do drugs now like they used to back in the 60s. And there I kind of discovered, Mr. Skeptic at the Esalen Institute, right? I mean, this is sort of a hotbed of angels and all this sort of New Age flapdoodle, as we would call it. But in fact, when I looked past the whatever the particular things people believe that I didn't, I could see that these folks were all on a journey, the same kind of journey that I'm on, the same kind of journey that Dinesh is on, that we're all on, trying to, you know, make sense of the world. And so since I'm a science guy, that's sort of the perspective I bring to it. And so I write, does a scientific explanation for the world diminish its spiritual beauty? I think not. Science and spirituality are complementary, not conflicting. Additive, not detractive. Anything that generates a sense of awe may be a source of spirituality. Science does this in space. I'm deeply moved, for example, when I observe through my 8-inch reflecting telescope in my backyard the fuzzy little patch of light that is the Andromeda Galaxy. It's not just because it is lovely, but because I also understand that the photons of light landing on my retina left Andromeda 2.9 million years ago, when our ancestors were tiny-brained hominids roaming the plains of Africa. I'm doubly stirred because it was not until 1923 that the astronomer Edwin Hubble, using the 100-inch telescope on Mount Wilson, just above my home in the foothills of Pasadena, discovered that this nebula was actually an extragalactic stellar system of immense size and distance. Hubble subsequently discovered that the light from most galaxies has shifted toward the red end of this electromagnetic spectrum, literally unweaving a rainbow of colors, meaning that the universe is expanding away from an explosive creation. It was the first empirical evidence indicating that the universe had a beginning and thus is not eternal. What could be more awe-inspiring, more numinous, magical, spiritual, than this cosmic visage? Mount Wilson Observatory is the Shark Cathedral of our time. I write that because I've been in Shark, which is also a very spiritually moving place to go. What science tells us is that we are but one among hundreds of millions of species that evolved over the course of 3.5 billion years on one tiny planet among many orbiting an ordinary star, itself one of possibly billions of solar systems in an ordinary galaxy that contains hundreds of billions of stars, itself located in a cluster of galaxies not so different from the millions of other galaxy clusters, themselves whirling away from one another in an accelerating, expanding, cosmic bubble universe. There very possibly is only one among a near infinite number of bubble universes. Herein lies the spiritual side of science. It's scientuality, if you'll pardon an awkward neologism, but one that echoes the sensuality of discovery. If religion and spirituality are supposed to generate awe and humility in the face of the Creator, what could be more awesome and humbling than the deep space discovered by Hubble and the cosmologists and the deep time discovered by Darwin and the evolutionists? So Darwin matters because evolution matters, and evolution matters because science matters, and science matters because it is the preeminent story of our age, an epic saga about who we are, where we came from, and where we're going.